Joseph Priestley was an 18th century British scientist, theologian, and political philosopher. He's credited with the discovery of oxygen and was among the most accomplished and famous men of his generation, rivaled only by Benjamin Franklin in the diversity of his interests and influence. He helped found the Unitarian Church, and among his closest friends were the great minds of the Enlightenment and the early Industrial Revolution. Yet today he's a relatively little-known figure. Our guest today is Stephen Johnson, author of The Invention of Air, A Story of Science, Faith, Revolution, and the Birth of America. He joins us from our Boston studio at WGBH. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
It's something you mentioned in the preface of the book that gives us an idea of just how important Priestley was to our founding fathers is the fact that in the 13-year final correspondence between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, where they reflected on their collaborations and their feuds, there were 165 letters. Benjamin Franklin mentioned by name 5 times, George Washington 3 times, Alexander Hamilton 2, and Joseph Priestley 52 times.
It's an amazing number. I think it's a measure of how influential he was to both Adams and Jefferson, particularly to Jefferson. Jefferson actually says in those letters that his whole vision of Christianity really rested on Priestley's writings on it. In many ways, Jefferson probably would not have considered himself a Christian had he not read the works of Priestley and not seen the way in which Priestley had managed to kind of reconcile science and faith. So right there you see his impact in really kind of stark terms.
Yeah. I have to say I had not heard of Joseph Priestley before reading this book. And after you look through, and we're going to talk about some of his accomplishments, it's amazing that we don't know who he is.
Well, somebody said after reading the book that it left you with this feeling of, what have I done with my life?
Yeah, you know? Right, exactly. You know?
The guy wrote something like 500 books and pamphlets. I've written 6 books, and I generally think that that's pretty good at the age of 40. And then I look at Priestley and think, oh, my God, I'm such an underachiever. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Now, Priestley and Ben Franklin had a long, close relationship, and it was actually Ben Franklin who helped Priestley become one of the great scientists of the age. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the first half of the book in some ways is this story of this wonderful friendship between Franklin and Priestley. And one of the great treats of writing this book is that so much of the correspondence between them survives. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's all online. People who are interested and can go check it out. And so you see in many ways the actual conversations and these ideas flowing back and forth between these men preserved in their original form, right? You see the letters that actually conveyed the ideas to each other, which is wonderful to see. They had met in 1765 in a coffee house in London, and coffee house culture is kind of crucial to this story in some ways. And Priestley had this idea that he wanted to write a book about the history of electricity because there had been this enormous, really interesting kind of run of scientific and kind of technological success with electricity over the preceding 50 years, which Franklin had been, of course, a pioneering force in. And Priestley had this idea that there should be a popular account of all these advances, that someone should write a book in English, not in Latin, as many people would write scientific tracts in those days. And it should tell a story of progress, and it should talk about the techniques so that other people could get inspired. And Franklin would be one of the heroes of the book. And so he wrote this book and really, in part, invented the whole genre of popular science writing, which is partially how I make my living to this day. So I owe this to Joseph Priestley. And he actually was the first person who wrote publicly about the legendary story of Franklin and the kite.
Right.
Every school kid knows that story in part because Joseph Priestley decided to put it into his book. And Franklin encouraged Priestley to start doing his own experiments. And so Priestley actually did a few interesting experiments with electricity during that period. But then he got interested in chemistry, and that's when he really started to do his pioneering work.
Exactly. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, he's credited with the discovery of oxygen. And what's interesting here is I guess he really wasn't the first. Tell us about that. And then the mint experiment, which gets little mentioned yet is quite profound.
Yeah, in some ways I'm trying to shift a little bit of the of his reputation from one experiment to the other. So he's for people who know him, they probably know of him as the guy who discovered oxygen. But in a funny way, he wasn't the first person to isolate oxygen for the first time. He was the first person to publish it, but he got he kind of misunderstood what he had discovered, and he gave it a terrible name, dephlogisticated air, and he didn't really have a kind of systematic understanding of what he had stumbled across, and it really wasn't until the French chemist Antoine Lavoisier, several years later, building on Priestley's work, really developed a much more cohesive theory and in a sense invented modern chemistry and actually gave it the name of oxygen. So Priestley somehow got the kind of accolades for that, which he doesn't fully deserve. But he also did something else, which I think with hindsight maybe is just as important, and that is that he was the first person to realize that plants were creating oxygen, that the whole reason we have an atmosphere to breathe is because that atmosphere has been concocted by plants in the photosynthesis process. So the natural Priestley didn't fully realize this at the time, but the natural composition of the Earth's atmosphere would be less than 1% oxygen. But for millions and millions and millions of years, it has been remarkably stable at about 20.7% oxygen. And that's because, you know, billions of years ago, plants evolved this technique for making a living by trapping the sun's rays. And they basically expelled this waste product of oxygen that was initially incredibly poisonous to everything living around. But over time, creatures evolved that were able to actually use that oxygen, and we are the descendants of those creatures.
Yeah, and fascinating too, because he wasn't expecting that outcome. You know, he had put other things in his glass jars, you know, spiders and mice and what have you, and they would expire. And he was expecting the mint to do the same, and was... What's going on here?
Yeah, everybody knew that if you sealed up a mouse in a glass jar, eventually they would die because they would run out of air, and they weren't sure quite why, but they knew that. And he thought, well, I'm sure that would happen with a plant. So he put a plant in a sealed glass jar and came back a couple of weeks later, and the plant was growing. So then he had this brilliant idea, which was he was going to burn all the air out of the vessel so that there would be no air in there. And then surely, I mean, when you did that with a mouse – you know, the mouse would start to die immediately because there was no air to breathe, you know, instantly right at that point. And when he did this with the plant, he came back, you know, he burns all the air out. The candle inside the vessel gets extinguished because there's nothing left to burn, and it won't light again because there's no oxygen there to combust. And he comes back 2 weeks later, and he basically uses a little lens to concentrate the sun's rays so that he can light the candle, and the candle lights.
Yeah.
And so somehow the oxygen, some breathable, combustible substance has gotten in there somehow. And so he starts to think, the plant must have done it.
Yeah, it's wild.
How can that be?
Yeah, we're talking with Stephen Johnson, author of The Invention of Air. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to join our conversation, is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. And Joel is giving us a call from Brewster. Good morning, Joel.
Hi. Sorry for the interruption. I want to get back to Ben Franklin for just a quickie. One always hears that his kite string got hit by some lightning, and then he was able to witness the spark when he held a key up to it, I guess, grounding it. I would have thought that would have fused any wire light enough for a kite to lift. Might he have just been trickling off a very local charge around the wire from the ions up there, or could it really have been hit by lightning?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I don't know the answer. I don't think anybody really knows the answer. And of course, it was incredibly risky on some level what he was doing. And
one more. I don't understand how anybody could get through the mandatory high school science courses without knowing all about Priestley, but it's a fascinating discussion, so I'll let you get back to it. Right. Thank you.
Thanks, Joel, for your phone call. Appreciate it. Thanks for calling. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. He had a lot of interesting inventions. He also invented soda water.
That's a classic Priestley story on a couple of levels. So he moves – this is actually how he got interested in gas and in air in the first place. He moves to Leeds, gets a job as a local minister there, and the official house that he's supposed to move into isn't ready. So he moves into this temporary house, and it happens to abut a brewery. And so there's kind of this brewery in his backyard. And so always the kind of inquisitive sort, he goes wandering over one day and starts looking at these giant vats of beer that are kind of brewing. And he notices there's this kind of haze coming off of them. And so he starts talking to the proprietors and says, hey, would you mind if I just did some science experiments here in your brewery? Which I just is a classic image of this crazy minister coming over and asking to set up a little science lab over their beer. And so he notices in the course of these experiments that if you pour water back and forth over the beer, it basically got carbonated and it developed this, you know, kind of delightful fizzy property. And so he invented soda water, seltzer water. And typical of Priestley, he did nothing to try and profit from it at all. He immediately published it, wrote to all of his friends about it. He said, "Oh, I've invented this. This is how you do it. This is really cool." He published a little pamphlet about it. And you know, a few years later, a certain Mr. Johannes Schweppes decided to patent his tonic water and, you know, made a mint off of it. Right. We're still paying his family royalties, I think. But Priestley just wanted to share everything that he's discovered.
And that was what was kind of unusual, that he did want to share his information, that whole information network that you talk about. But he had this ideas had to move. They had to circulate.
Yeah. And, you know, it wasn't unusual. And so I think it seems unusual to us now, but it was very much the kind of the ethos that Franklin had and that Jefferson had and that much Enlightenment science had. You didn't really have the idea of kind of trade secrets and kind of industrial R&D where people are furtively in a lab somewhere not sharing. It was all about coming up with an idea, publishing it, letting other people improve on it. And Franklin was hugely committed to this. I mean, he has a great line somewhere that he wrote in the 1750s saying it's all about getting ideas out there so that the attention of the ingenious will come to these ideas and make them even better.
You write, there were dozens of paradigm shifts in distinct fields during Priestley's lifetime, watershed moments of sudden progress where new rules and frameworks of understanding emerged. Priestley alone was a transformative figure in four of them: chemistry, electricity, politics, and faith. So what was it that enabled Priestley to be involved in so many intellectual revolutions all at the same time?
Well, that's, you know, maybe the big single question that the book is trying to wrestle with is why do massive intellectual changes happen when they do, and why sometimes is one person connected to so many of them? And I think the only way to fully answer that question is really to look at kind of multiple scales of experience. So part of it is Priestley himself. He was a brilliant guy. There's no question about it. Part of it is his particular method was very well suited to the problems he was working on. Part of it is the information network of the day, as you mentioned, the open sharing of ideas, the coffeehouse culture where people from different backgrounds would come together and talk about all their different interests. That was crucial to what he did. And the answer to the question of why things happen even gets bigger than that and gets to the whole question of the flow of energy through society at any given point in time. So Priestley had a lot of leisure time, particularly in the late 1770s and 1780s. And in the 1780s, a lot of that leisure time was given to him by the rising kind of industrial class of folks who were, you know, building these great fortunes by extracting stored energy out of the coal deposits of northern England. Right. And so without that leisure time to do his experiments that was basically being paid for by industrialization, which was in a sense created because of all this coal, he wouldn't have been able to do what he was doing. So to answer the question of why Priestley at that time, you have to be able to kind of go everywhere from, you know, this guy's mind all the way to, you know, coal that was originally created 300 million years before in the Carboniferous era.
Yeah, I found that fascinating too, that you talk about the French paleontologist who discovered fossils from the Carboniferous era and, you know, the gigantic plant life and alien flies or dragonflies that are, you know, you wouldn't think they would be able to fly. And you talk about that, and that carbon in England, in that area, which really made them, you know, what they were as far as beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
That's right. And it's connected to Priestley's ideas because one of the things that happened was there was a really pronounced spike in oxygen content right around the Carboniferous about 350 million years ago. And it rose to about 35% from 20%. And it's a big question of why oxygen levels are so constant. And so a lot of scientists have looked at that in the last, you know, 20 or 30 years. And one of the things that they found in that era is they had these giant, you know, dragonflies and things like that that were able to fly and able to kind of, you know, have a metabolism that worked because the air was so thick with oxygen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then all that matter gets buried underground. All these, you know, giant plants get buried. And that becomes the coal that the Industrial Revolution was powered by. So it's a very fun kind of connected web of forces.
It was great. We're talking with Stephen Johnson, author of The Invention of Air. He's joining us from our Boston studio at WGBH. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to join the conversation or if you have a question, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. All right, so we established this relationship with Ben Franklin. Let's talk about John Adams. That was sort of his next, he met John Adams before he was sent away from England, and we'll get into that in a minute.
Yeah, he met John Adams. It's kind of a transition. His friendship was kind of fading with Franklin because Franklin had gone back to America and was in France. So they kept up a correspondence for the rest of their lives, but they never saw each other again after Franklin left London. But he meets Adams in a bookstore in London in the 1780s, and there's this wonderful thing. Actually, I've tracked this down right at the end of the book. Actually, I found this quote. I was trying to find some record of Adams acknowledging meeting Priestley, and I hadn't seen anybody make a reference to this. And I found in Adams' diaries this note about meeting Priestley at this bookstore and talking about various interesting things. And then the entry ends with him saying, "Seeds were sown this day, which will grow." And it turns out to be very prophetic because Priestley and Adams have this really complicated history in the coming decades. And it's just a beautiful little hint of preview of coming attractions, basically.
Right. Now, we know that Priestley was outspoken in his religious and political beliefs. And I'm wondering if you talk a little bit about he was driven out of England by violent mobs.
That's right. In the 1780s, he grew a little bit more open in some of his writings. He had been actually one of the most vocal British supporters of the American cause in the American Revolution, which didn't make him a lot of friends in certain circles in England. And then he wrote more about his kind of religious values in the 1780s and gave a couple of relatively incendiary speeches. And his view was basically that it was kind of an interesting mix of a very devout believer in the word of Christ who was nonetheless extremely eccentric in his views and outside the kind of orthodoxy about what Christianity really meant. And he believed that that Christianity had, in his words, been corrupted by layers and layers of kind of interpretation by priests and theologians over the centuries who had added a whole kind of massive supernatural elements to the story of Christ. And so he believed that being, you know, a true Christian was about getting back to that core message and not believing in saints or in resurrections or in Holy Ghosts and things like that. And that, you know, that's kind of the part of the premise of Unitarianism. And so he published a number of things about that and basically also supported the French Revolution when that erupted on the other side of the channel. And so by 1790, 1791, he'd actually become in some ways the most hated man in all of England. I mean, he really, there were a lot of more conservative forces who thought he was very dangerous. And eventually, incited by this dinner party that folks were allegedly going to be throwing in support of the French Revolution, an angry mob kind of gathered, burned down a bunch of churches and meeting houses in Birmingham, and then took off for Priestley's house on the outskirts of Birmingham to kill Priestley and to destroy his property. And fortunately, Priestley managed to escape, but they burned down his house. They destroyed his lab, which had all this kind of state-of-the-art scientific equipment, destroyed a lot of his writings and correspondence. And Priestley tried to stay with his family, but just never really felt safe in England again until in 1794 he set sail for America. And in doing that, this is another way in which he's kind of bound up in the early story of our country. He really became the first great scientist exile to come to America. You think of all the folks who have followed in his footsteps since then. And he was greeted as a hero, had tea with Washington several times, had spent a lot of time with Adams, and then started to develop this friendship with Jefferson that lasted to the end of his life.
Before we get into that, I want to talk to David, who's calling from Edgartown. Hi, David.
Hey there.
Go ahead.
There's nothing worse, I suppose, than one historian correcting another historian, but I heard one little bit on Schwepp that I felt needed to be corrected.
Okay, go ahead.
First off, his name was not Johann, it was Jacob, and it was Schwepp without the S on the end. The S was later added.
Oh, good. That's very helpful. Thank you.
And he actually started out in Geneva, with two other men, and it was a man by the name of Goossens who actually developed the pump to charge water. And the other man was a man by the name of Elias Paul, who later moved to Paris and started a company there. And then Schwepp went from there to Bristol, England. And it said that he had two daughters, one that was very attractive, one that wasn't so attractive. The one that wasn't so attractive worked in the back making the stuff, and the attractive one was out in the shop.
David, thank you for that.
That's great. Thank you.
Appreciate you.
All righty. By the way, I think the whole story of Priestley is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book. Thank you, David,
thank
for the phone call.
Thank you.
I appreciate that.
And I love Edgartown. I've spent a lot of fun times there. I wish I were there right now.
Maybe you want to wait till the weather's a little bit warmer.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Let's talk about Thomas Jefferson. You touched on this a little bit earlier in the program. He read The Corruptions and was really moved.
Yeah, Jefferson had spent, you know, an immense amount of time trying to reconcile his Enlightenment era kind of belief in reason and science with Christian values. And, you know, he kind of famously described himself as kind of belonging to a sect of one and had, you know, very unorthodox views about these things, but was trying to kind of hang on to it. Unlike Franklin, who really – I mean, Priestley once said of Franklin that it was too bad such a great man was really an unbeliever because, you know – and actually Priestley had a great line about that. Ever the optimist, he was like, I think it's mostly because he never really – he was too busy to read all the books that I gave him on religion, which I thought was quite funny. When Jefferson read the Corruptions, he suddenly – it was as if there was this kind of key that Priestley had given him that kind of unlocked this puzzle for him, which was a way of saying, okay, listen, no, you can be a Christian. You just have to get back to the roots of Christ himself and not pay attention to all this other stuff. And it was a kind of story that Jefferson liked to hear. He was always kind of imagining things about kind of there was some original state that people had to get back to that had been corrupted by modern culture and modern life and by cities and things like that. And so – so he, you know, he ultimately said, "This is the kind of bedrock of my faith." And you know, Jefferson famously created this Jefferson's Bible that was kind of a remix, we would say, a mashup of the Bible, where he basically eliminated all the passages that involved, you know, kind of magic and supernatural things, and just got back to the kind of core story. And that was, you know, an attempt to take Priestley's theory and kind of put it into practice and rewrite the Bible according to the vision of Christianity that Priestley had outlined.
Yeah. Now we have Priestley here, a man of faith, a man of science, a man of politics, when you look in our age, generally separated and specialized, and as you say, often lined up to oppose and even to reject one another.
Yeah, and this is certainly a book that is a celebration of the, you know, multidisciplinary kind of amateur dabbling and thinking across boundaries that Priestley and the founders all embodied. And it's very much trying to say that, you know, this is the kind of intellectual heritage of this country, right? When we think about the founding fathers, you know, they were about making connections between science and politics and faith. They were not about kind of building walls or pretending to not know anything about them or thinking that a knowledge of science was just not relevant to what they did. So when we take these positions or when our leaders take those positions, I think it's important for us to look back at this kind of story and say, no, you're betraying the values that, you know, this country was created on top of. But on the other hand, you can't be too sentimental about it. You can't it is much harder to isolate fundamental gases in your home lab today
exactly.
For the first time than it was in Priestley's time. And the fact that we are specialized in so many ways is also a sign of progress because so much has been discovered, and you do need to go to grad school now for 6 years and probably work for 20 years to be able to make fundamental discoveries in these various fields. But what I'm trying to argue for is, in a sense, is to at least recognize the importance and the merits of having, you know, kind of a wide-ranging layperson's understanding of all these things.
Yeah.
Because to be a kind of modern citizen of the world and not think about energy issues and environmental issues and think about computer science and all that it's done to the world through the internet, it's not responsible on some level.
Something you talk about in all of your books is a long zoom approach to history. Explain what that is.
Well, that's what we were talking about in a sense before when we were discussing the question of why these things happened. You know, it's my belief, and this is something I did in my last book, The Ghost Map, which was about a cholera outbreak in London that I think changed the world in a number of important ways, is that you have to look across these different scales. And sometimes you have to jump from kind of discipline to explain what actually is happening in a given moment in history. So in this case, you have to be able to understand what was going on in Priestley's individual life, but you also have to think about that information network, and you have to think about the flows of energy through society. And you have to maybe even go down to the level of neuroscience and think about how ideas take shape in the human brain. You know, how is the brain wired to for kind of creativity and innovation, and how does that intersect with a particular historical reality at a given time? And unless you figure out a way to kind of connect all those different scales in the story that you tell, in the explanatory story that you tell, you're missing part of the full scope of it. And so what I like about this in the context of this story is that it's a very Priestley way of approaching things, right? I mean, he was all about connecting across these different disciplines.
Absolutely.
And thinking across these different scales. So it's kind of fitting to try to tell the story of his life through that approach.
And you mentioned he had a lot of leisure time to be able to dabble in all these different areas. And so I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how he was able to support his family and how in his endeavors.
Well, he went through a couple of different things. So he early in his life, he taught and was a minister. So he was able to kind of cobble together enough money to get by. He made a little bit of money from publishing some of these books, but not very much. He had a system that doesn't really exist to this day of subscribers. And subscribers were kind of like a group of patrons who would get, you know, kind of first editions of whatever he wrote. But they were more giving him money because he was kind of a good cause. For a while in the 1770s, he had a patron, Lord Shelburne, who had been prime minister and would ultimately be important in negotiating the end of the Revolutionary War, who brought him to his estate, which I actually just visited a couple of months ago. It was a beautiful, beautiful estate near Bath. And that's where he actually did the oxygen experiments, the isolating of oxygen experiments. And his lab is still preserved there if people want to go back and see it. But then he was supported by the Lunar Society in Birmingham by the kind of early industrial class there for the 1780s. And that was in some ways the happiest period of his life because he was supported by people who were really his kind of intellectual peers.
Right. And reading about his family was very enjoyable, too. He had a wonderful family. And it's just a great read. It is The Invention of Air, A Story of Science, Faith, Revolution, and the Birth of America by Stephen Johnson. Stephen, thank you so much.
Oh, really enjoyed the conversation.
And we should mention that Stephen will be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight at 7 p.m. I want to thank Andrea Rule and Alan Mattis for production assistance in Boston. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is hosted and produced by Mindy Todd. The executive producer is Steve Young. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.